From VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Adam Teeter.
And I'm Joanna Sciarrino.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal.
And this is the VinePair Podcast. Zach, kick us off while you've been drinking, man. Let's just get right into it.
Yeah. So as you all are listening to this, I will probably have more interesting things to report. But as we record, Caitlin has been in Hong Kong for almost a Ooh. Week now. So I've been mostly not drinking, not because I don't want to, but just the end of the day with the kids is I'm kind of wiped. And so I've had a couple of little things here and there. I did dip into, I got a bottle of the Balvenie Caribbean Cask 14-year single malt for my
That's
birthday.
A nice one.
And yeah, so I definitely the other night poured myself some of that. That was a nice treat. But I mean, honestly, like it's been like I had a beer and I don't even remember what beer it was one of the nights because we were having like bratwurst and it was like, all right, I'm gonna have a beer with this, but you know, not opening bottles of wine when it's just me and the kids, and not certainly not going out anywhere because again, just home from from the time I pick them up from school till I collapse into my bed at night. So yeah, you know, real exciting life over here, but hoping to have more exciting drinking experiences to relay next week. So I don't know. Hopefully the two of you have been doing more fun stuff than me. Mm.
Joanna?
Yeah. Well, Adam mentioned the after hours cocktails that we had earlier or last week, whenever. Anyway, with Brian Miller, Tiki Monday, the pain reliever was really excellent.
Amazing.
With like the little bit of coffee in it and some fresh nutmeg on top. And I really liked the take on the old fashioned too.
It's delicious.
Which was like four different rums.
Yeah.
And
then served basically straight up.
Yeah.
Stirred, up almost like you would serve, why can't I think of it now?
A Sazerac.
Yeah.
Funny you should say Sazerac because I also had a really good Sazerac this weekend.
Really?
Yeah, from a restaurant. I wanted to mention in our last conversation we were talking about this, but just like this.
But you forgot.
No, I didn't. I intentionally didn't because I wanted to save it. But it was a steakhouse and I was super impressed with how it was served. It was in a chilled glass and it was excellent.
I love a Sazerac.
Yeah.
It's a great cocktail.
When do you ever order one?
Never.
Like, never.
I actually ordered, the last time I think I ordered it was, I was in Auburn, Alabama visiting my parents and like my mom and dad took us and my brother, whatever, to like this restaurant that had just opened. Auburn's getting a lot of, like this one chef came to Auburn. Now all these other chefs are coming to Auburn and opening stuff, which
interesting.
Is interesting. Sort
okay.
of interesting how that happens. And this place kind of was a take on Terrain, to be honest, which I don't know if anyone's familiar with Terrain.
I know Terrain, like, yeah.
You know, garden store and then a fancy restaurant. That same thing. Yeah. The guy bought like this piece of land right outside Auburn that has a lake and he has this huge garden store and gardens and then the restaurant. And I was looking at the cocktail list and they had a Sazerac. And I was like, I haven't had one of these in forever. And it was very great. It was very good.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the last time. So that was around Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I was just trying. The first Sazerac I ever had was in New Orleans at like one of the bars where you were supposed to have the Sazerac. It was awful. It was one of those things where it's like, don't have the drink where it was created kind of thing.
Yeah. I had one in New Orleans as well. And it was one of the first times I had it for my brother-in-law's bachelor party. And also was awful. It was at the Carousel Bar. It was horrible. Horrible.
yeah.
And he wanted to go there. He's like, everyone told me we got to go to Sazerac at the Carousel Bar. And I was like, okay. And we went and I was like, this sucks. And it was expensive. Okay. You know, and you're like, oh, God. Anyways.
What have you been having, Adam?
So two really great drinks recently. One was I was so Tip Top, just such a thoughtful company. And they sent me their new Mai Tai.
How was it?
Ooh.
Fucking delicious. Naomi had two of them.
I've heard, yeah.
She was like, these are so good.
Mm-hmm.
Really, again, just very easy, right? You shake it in the can, pour it into the glass. Also, people who say that like they're annoyed that a canned cocktail company would tell you how that you have to either shake it or stir it or whatever afterwards are honestly people that I think are sad in their own lives. Like, you just, you know what I mean? There was an article that someone wrote that was like, another journalist that was like, oh, if you tell me what I have to do with your cocktail that's supposed to, that I should be able to drink from the can or from the bottle, like, this isn't really an RTD and blah, blah, blah. And this, you know what?
I missed that one.
Oh.
I got to look it up after.
You know, I feel sorry for you.
I get it. Don't you get it, right? But now, like, you're like, oh, I can't take this Mai Tai to a picnic.
No, whatever. I still think it's stupid. Honestly, I'm sure that you could drink it out of the can and be fine, but it's much better pouring it over ice, shaking it in the can first and pouring it over ice, and it was delicious, and really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
They make good drinks.
Yeah, their stuff is good.
And then the other experience I had that I already told you about earlier today was last week we went to a concert at BAM to see Cateno Valeso.
Love that guy.
It was amazing. Mm-hmm. It was really awesome.
It's a guy, right? It's a band?
It's a guy. Well, he's played with a bunch of different musicians throughout his career. Dude, he's 81 years old and looks amazing. And he was dancing on stage and his band was incredible.
Yeah.
And beforehand, we went to one of my favorite restaurants in Fort Greene called Omagrasa, which is an incredible pizza place.
Yeah.
Like sourdough pizza, you know, really, you know, bougie pizza.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a great wine list. And the... you know, beverage director walked over and I was like, look, I'm just like really looking for, it was the four of us. We want something sort of a lighter red, lower in alcohol, you know, more on the affordable side. We're each going to basically have a glass and a half. So just one bottle before we go to the show. And he was like, have you ever had the Hervé Suchat Sauterne Gamay? And I was like, no, I've only ever had their Syrah. Their Syrah was our number one wine of the year this year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was fucking amazing. Gamay from the Rhone.
Yeah.
Who knew?
So good. So good. $65.
Yeah.
And I'm nice. Like, wow, they're doing the work. Why isn't another bar in the same neighborhood doing the work? Anyways, but it was, now I know the rep is here, clearly. Mm-hmm. I'm like, let's make it work. It was really delicious.
Nice.
And I haven't had this experience in a while where, like, our friends literally commented on how good the wine was. We're like, holy shit, this is good. Where can we get this?
Hmm.
Which is always fun when, like, you're the person that kind of was put in charge of ordering the wine, even though I didn't do shit. Like, the beverage director is the one who recommended it. I wasn't like, oh, yeah, let's get this. That's also, but it was fun. That was great.
Did a good job then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So today's topic's a real spicy one. So there is a video that has been put out online that's been sent to me by no less than at least 20 people now in the wine industry.
Really?
Yes. Have you seen this? Those of you that are listeners of this pod will be able to figure out what this video is, but if not, do your own research. A former prominent New York Somm who has since become a winemaker in California has been putting out a lot of videos about American wine recently, but the one that I want to kick off our conversation about is a video that was put out recently. So this Somm used to be a proponent of natural wine. Now apparently they are not and claim to have never been, which is weird. And also was always a proponent of wines from all over the world, but especially from Europe. They were a huge proponent of European wine. I actually wrote a profile of them a long time ago where they told me that, you know, they feel like they were one of the Somms that made Clos Regard famous in New York. So, you know, big French Somm focused a lot on French wine, very famous for hopping up on the bar and savoring champagne, but now is an American winemaker in California. And so they put out a video that basically was asking a question, but also it was like one of these like questions, but also a statement, right? Like when you say, please, at the end of a talk, we only are looking for questions, not statements. This was a both. And it was basically, I believe their opinion, which some of their other Somm friends did disagree with, that it is criminal for restaurants that are located in or near wine regions to not have some of the wines from that region on their wine list, even if that restaurant is of a different cuisine than that region. Like Italian, because this is America, right? So if you are a fine restaurant with a wine program, it is criminal for you not to have wines from that region on your list. I think that's such fucking bullshit. Such fucking bullshit. And I think the only reason that comment is being made is because now you are a winemaker that needs to sell your wines. And let me, we can talk about all of this, but I'll tell you my hot take on this one first. It is amazing to romanticize Europe. And it is great that we think that the way Europe does things is the way it should be in terms of wine, right? It's cool when you are traveling to go to Bordeaux and basically only see Bordeaux on all the restaurant wine lists. It is cool to go to Piemonte and basically only see Barolos and Barbarescos and Nebbiolos and Arnaiz, et cetera, although Arnaiz is kind of getting phased out, which is really sad, on all of the restaurant wine lists. But that is Europe. Also, what you usually see is the same kind of cuisine at all those restaurants, because it's very regionally specific. What is amazing about America is that, again, whether or not you like it, it's the best system we have. It's called capitalism. And people are allowed to sell wines that make them money and that are that help identify and, you know, make up their own restaurant program. So, like, I was talking to Keith. You know how ridiculous it would have been if he was doing an Italian wine bar, an Italian restaurant in the East Village, if he had felt like he had pressure to put North Fork and Finger Lakes wines on his list? That's ridiculous. People are going to Invino to have the Italian wine bar experience. They can go somewhere else and have wines from the North Fork and the Finger Lakes. I think those are great wines, but he should not be told that it is criminal for him to not put those wines on his list. And I think it's a lot of the narrative of this conversation, I feel like, is like it's up to everyone else. We need to support only American wine now, which is not what was being said earlier in the career of this person. But also, no, it should always be, unfortunately, again, with capitalism, it's up to you to sell your wines.
Right.
It's up to you to convince people to buy your wines. It's up to you to invest in the marketing. And if you can't, then maybe you won't be able to be in business. Like, that's the way that this works, right? Capitalism is the best system we've got. And people that are successful are usually successful because they bust their asses and they work really hard to sell their product. People don't owe you anything in capitalism. And it is what it is. But I think that it's really interesting how the perspectives in this industry always change for the people depending on what they happen to be doing at the moment. And, you know, look, here's the deal. Like, you weren't trying to take care of any of these producers when you were on the other end and you wanted to have a diverse list that reflected the things you were into at the moment. So, like, you can't now call people out for doing the same thing you were doing.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I understand their argument, right? We've had this conversation when Hannah was on the podcast and she wrote a piece about American wine lists, right? Well, or all American wine lists, rather. And we talked about this, right? Like, it would be lovely if every restaurant that was, you know, only using locally grown produce and animals and was all about farm to table decided that their list should reflect that their wine list and beverage program should reflect the same thing instead of, you know, importing bottles from around the world. Like, that doesn't make sense. It doesn't follow the same philosophy. Yeah. It's hypocritical, whatever. But like you said, restaurants have to make money.
Yeah.
It's really tough time for restaurants still now to do that. And the other part of this that we've talked about pretty extensively at this point is that to sell these types of wines, or wines that people are less familiar with, right? If people think of American wine, they think of Napa Cab and maybe like Riesling from the Finger Lakes or something like that, that it takes a lot of education for people to actually buy those bottles. They're probably expensive. And we don't have the wine professional. We don't have as many wine professionals at restaurants anymore these days. So I think it is, it's a pretty exorbitant ask, I think, from this person.
Yeah.
Without consideration for all of these other factors that we've discussed in the past.
Yeah. There is a wine region that did this. It's Napa. Just like you said, you used to go to Napa and you only saw Napa wines on the wine list. And guess what? People who lived in Napa and winemakers in Napa complained that they couldn't then drink wines from everywhere else. And then two places popped up that became wildly successful. One we love called Cadet, the other whatever. And, you know, that's what happened because there was demand for it. And Cadet is very successful. Like, it just is what it is. Like, anyways, go Zach.
Yeah, so I think there's like a couple of different things swirling around here. I think the notion that it would be good for American wine professionals, wherever they are, to be more familiar with and perhaps more, bigger advocates for American wine, especially perhaps American wine that's not just the very highly coveted, you know, very expensive Napa wines. I think that's, to me, an unobjectionable statement. And again, it's aligned with what we talked about when Hannah was on. And I think there's a lot to that. And I mentioned during that episode, and I mentioned it before, being really surprised at, when I was more in the sommelier scene here in Seattle, how many of my colleagues here were deeply uncurious about and really kind of not that invested in the local wine industry, which, again, was kind of bizarre to me, not just because it was close by and we should be supporting local business, but from the standpoint of, at least in my restaurants, and certainly in, I think, a lot of their restaurants, a lot of the people dining, whether they were locals or people traveling, were interested in local wine. And to be ill-prepared to talk about that was, to me, just you weren't doing your job right. And I think that was not universal, but I think it was true. And I think in part because a lot of sommeliers, especially younger sommeliers and wine professionals, but people of all ages, were following the lead of people like this sommelier turned winemaker who were so clearly fixated on Europe and in particular France and in particular a few regions in France and in particular a few producers in those regions in France and in particular one wine style from those producers in those regions in France to the exclusion of basically everything else. And look, you know, this person coming out and talking about how they feel like they couldn't, you know, sort of be truthful about what they really believed because there was some sort of cabal of wine professionals who were going to come after them is the most laughable fucking thing I've heard in a long time. This person was at the forefront of the wine industry. As Adam mentioned, he wrote a profile of this person. This person was profiled in the New York Times. They had had and have about as much clout as any sommelier, any wine professional has had in this country. And to say that they were somehow unable to sort of be truthful about what they believed because they were going to get shamed for it is fucking ridiculous.
You can I respond to that? That's sure. That's like a moderate Republican saying that they weren't actually a Trump supporter after Trump loses and takes away women's rights to choose. Right. I mean, that's basically what that was.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much wanting to have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
And to come back to my point, I think there's some truth to the notion that as a whole, the American wine professional community should be more aware of, more in tune with, and frankly, a bigger advocate for the American wine industry in a variety of ways. I think that is something that I do agree with. I also think that what you both have said, which is that it's preposterous to tell restaurants across the country or even in and around these specific regions that they have some sort of obligation to sell and serve wine from American producers is sort of silly. Like, part of what has to happen here is there has to be a symbiotic relationship, right? The producers need to be making wine that sells and that has demand. And look, this producer has talked about recently how the wines they made just a few years ago suck now because they didn't sulfur or filter them. Like, no shit, people don't want to buy those wines. Like, again, in a sense, trying to kind of conflate this individual person struggling at their adopted profession of winemaker with not a lot of training with some sort of broad crisis is one of the more objectionable things to me here. There are real issues facing the American wine industry. Smaller producers do struggle to get placement. Yeah. They struggle to find traction in a distribution landscape that is dominated by a couple of big companies, and they struggle to break out against the, you know, kind of overwhelming drumbeat of Napa, 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 Napa. But again, one individual winery failing or struggling is not a fucking crisis. It's just a business struggling, failing perhaps. And that happens. And as Adam said, that's what capitalism do. And so I don't really understand why this has become a sort of this sort of like broader movement, especially when, as pointed out before, this person has been incredibly hypocritical about their stance on this when it behooved them to be a fierce advocate for natural wine from France. They were that. And now when it behooves them to be an advocate for whatever kind of wine they're making now in California, they are that. And if you, as the listener, as the whomever, are somehow like that doesn't strike you as a little self-serving on that person's behalf, I don't know what to say.
Yeah. I think two other issues I have with this is that, one, there's been no acknowledgement of the restaurants and wine professionals who are doing just this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The ones who we've covered.
Or even the writers who wrote about it.
Yeah, exactly. I think that is that's really disappointing. And then I think also, you know, there's this idea that he's alone in doing this, right? And he's feeling really lonely out there, and he's the only one drinking American wines. And I think that it's really shitty to be critical of other people.
Look at our review
and
database.
To shame them.
The majority of our reviews are American wineries. the majority of our reviews at VinePair, and they are up and coming winemakers that we have been championing for years because we believe in American wine. Keith believes in American wine as our tastings director. I believe in American wine. Josh believes in American wine. You believe in American wine, Joanna. You, Zach, like, I'm, yes, we.
Zach believes in Washington wine.
Specifically.
I believe in American wine. I want to be very clear.
We all
about
do. I'm sorry. 10 years ago when I started VinePair, and look, the restaurants that were cool in New York at the time when Josh and I started VinePair were restaurants owned by this person and other people, like some of the other people in this world, like one named after a first name and an animal that flies, a bird. They were the cool restaurants, right? And none of them were serving these wines. And I would go to some of these tastings, and I would go with Keith, and we would say, my first year anniversary, I know I've talked about this before, Naomi and I went to Virginia and visited wineries in Virginia. We have been talking about Virginia at this publication since before anybody else. And we would, Psalms in New York would say to us, there's no way they can make good wine there. That was the immediate response. There's no way. They said the same thing until fucking COVID. Most Psalms in New York never would give shit about the Finger Lakes. There's no way they can make good wine there.
Yeah.
Oh, now everybody loves the Finger Lakes. Like, again, I loved going up there. I loved the wines coming from that region for forever. Like, it's very interesting. Like, just, again, and this is not to be a we did this and they didn't do this. It's just it's a huge wine world out there. And I think my moral of the story is, like, let's maybe not always let a few beverage professionals that work on the floor or sell wine dictate the conversation of what's cool and what we should be paying attention to at the moment and what we shouldn't. Let's maybe let the entire country figure out for themselves what they like to drink in certain regions, et cetera. Like, if in New York we are more of a European-centric wine town, that makes sense. We're very close to Europe. It's a very international city. There's lots of different cuisines. We can be a city that drinks a more European wine than American wine. It just is what it is. In San Francisco, hopefully it's much more of a California wine drinking city because of where it's located, although it also has a lot of international components. Mm-hmm. Like, let's let the South embrace Napa cabs, etc., because they like it. It goes with their cuisine. It's that, like, I don't understand why we have to have this whole, like, across the board, the U.S. doesn't care about American wine. Like, and also, I think you want people to care about the wine. Yeah, you have to be promotional in a regard, and it can't be laden with guilt.
Yes.
It has to be
shame.
Yeah. And it has to
like
be
shaming others for this.
I want you to drink this because I think it's delicious, and I hope you think it's delicious too. And if your prices are really expensive, you got to explain why. The same thing we talk about with, like, brewers and distillers. Like, if your whiskey costs $150 and you're a craft whiskey maker, you better explain why. And if you can't, then, yeah, it's not going to work for you. And you also better be someone that is willing to go talk to lots of people and be on the road, et cetera. And, like, I've seen the American wine brands recently that have been successful. And I will tell you, almost all of them, the producer is an extremely nice person who is very personable, who talks to everybody, who I've never heard, who usually never hear, like, badmouth one publication over another or badmouth one beverage director over another. They're incredible networkers. They're nice to be with. You want to have a meal with them. Like, there's a lot of those people out there, and that's why their wines are successful. And that's why some of them get bought.
Yeah.
I also think that another piece here too is one of the things that's super instructive from this whole thing to me is that everyone, and whether you're a wine consumer, whether you're a publication or someone covering this industry, you should take caution when the person telling you about how wine should be made has never made wine themselves. And I think that that's something that, you know, I think we try to be very clear about on this podcast. You know, we don't make wine. We don't make spirits. We don't make beer. We don't have that kind of experience. And coming from, you know, so we don't talk about how that should be done. And I think that, again, someone who has never done it can't really talk about the realities of winemaking, because how could they? They, you know, you can read about it. You can be told about it. You can listen to podcasts about it. You can watch TV shows or whatever about it. But none of that is the same as doing it. And I am very, very aware of that. And whenever anyone asks me, one of the first things I say is, like, I don't know how to make wine. I understand that, you know, you need grapes and yeast and shit. But like, the point is, I would never want to make wine, I don't think. And I would certainly not feel even remotely qualified to begin doing any piece of making wine because I don't know what I'm doing. And therefore, I don't feel like it's ever my place to tell winemakers how they should do it. Certainly on the degree of sort of detail and frankly, kind of religious fanaticism that this kind of movement bred.
Yeah.
And I think too, the other piece I want to say here is, again, and this is as us on the media side, is something for us, I think, and people listening who are in that world, also maybe be a little bit skeptical of anyone who's really looking to generate attention for themselves. Like, I get it. We're all brands. Everyone has to promote. I don't have a problem with that, really. But part of the issue is that when the loudest voices get echoed over and over again, they're not getting echoed necessarily because they're right or even particularly knowledgeable. They're just getting repeated because they're loud.
I mean, I think, you know, the biggest thing that we need to stop here, which you've just mentioned, is like, and we've had prominent winemakers like Matt Crafton of Montelena on the podcast a long time ago talking about this, right? Is, look, you want to try to figure out what the additives are in wine and be upset if you hear someone's adding mega purple, et cetera. I'm all for that. Or you know, table sugar, et cetera. I'm all for that. But these questions that get asked mostly by wine professionals, like, how do you inoculate? Do you use a native fermentation? Well, I can taste the difference. No, you fucking can't. And then you're judging the wines based on that. Like, what are your vineyard practices? You don't know if where they're farming, they can do the practice that you've decided is the one practice everyone should do. You don't know, well, where do you get your cooperage? Who's your cooperage? Why are you? You're not the winemaker. You don't know why they're choosing the bottles or why they're choosing to use amphora or why they're just take the tour, be very respectful, listen to them talk about their craft and taste the wine and decide whether or not you like the fucking wine.
Are you talking about as consumers or like beverage professionals?
Early on in my career, I would be put on these trips with Psalms mm-hmm. and other writers. Mm-hmm. And there were certain questions that would always get asked. And then they would take that judgment into the tasting. For example, there was another very prominent Psalm that was based in New York who ran a very large Italian wine program for a bunch of restaurants who would always ask if people natively if they inoculated or they used native fermentation. And I would always be like, why are you asking? Like, I don't understand. How does that matter in terms of whether or not the wine's going to be good? And at the end of the day, like, why can't we just trust our palates if we like it or we don't like it? But then, and then that judgment always came into the tasting. And I've seen that often, right? Like, the answers that came before the tasting always then influence the tasting.
Well, I do think one of the points of going on a trip like that, and I kind of agree and disagree. I think it's important to ask questions. I think the biggest question you can ask is why, right? Like, that's the thing. I would never ask a producer, do you do this or do you not? And then make a judgment about them based on how they answered it. What I want to know is why. I mean, that's just who I am as a person. I'm curious. And so if a producer says, well, these wines we inoculate with yeast and these wines we ferment with native yeast or spontaneous yeast, I'm curious about why, right? Maybe there's a difference in the vineyards. Maybe the varieties are different. Maybe they're looking for a different style out of each of these things. I think a good sort of professional in whether you're a sommelier or a wine director or a writer or whatever, is always going to be asking questions like that. But you're right. They shouldn't be saying, I think one of these answers is right and one of these is wrong.
Or it shouldn't influence. Like, right. I guess my point was, if the answer to someone, if the answer is very simplistic, right? If it's, because usually I've found that people don't ask more questions as to why, which is the important thing that you're saying. Mm-hmm. So the answer, let's say that the person asking the question has a bias and thinks that they always think that wines that are natively fermented are better. Right? And this was the conversation we had with Matt. Remember when Matt came on and he was like,
yes.
Well, if the play, because it was when that was all in vogue.
Yeah. Well, those people, I'm going to say this, are dumb. Like, fundamentally, that is an incredibly stupid way to approach wine.
But then if it's like, well, I just always tend to like those wines better. And then you take that into going to taste the wines.
Yeah.
It's like,
sure.
No. Maybe ask them why. Well, it's very difficult here. Or as Matt explained to us on that podcast years and years ago, if you're in a winery where inoculation was done for decades and decades and decades, like, that's the yeast strain that's still in the air. That's what's going to inoculate. I mean, that's what's going to ferment, whether or not you think you're bringing what's coming in from the vineyard. So, like, you might as well try to potentially recreate that yeast through a lab that's in the vineyard and inoculate with that, because you're better off doing that with something that could actually stay alive than be killed by the major, you know, industrialized yeasts that are all in the air inside the winery at this point. Mm. Like, the only way you can clean that yeast out is fucking burning the place down, basically. Right? So those are things that you have to ask those questions, though, to try to understand.
Yeah.
And, I think, again, this entire sort of conversation that people have been having over the last few weeks is just, again, something that doesn't need to be as big of a deal as it is. Like, I don't think there's any war on American wine. There are going to be producers that are going to succeed and producers that are going to fail. And I think there are going to be champions of American wine. And those champions need to be, if you're an American winemaker, make those champions your best friend. Don't try to convince the people that aren't that they need to, right?
Even or if they're doing something wrong.
That they're doing something wrong. Even if they're former, like, colleagues or places you want to be, like, it is what it is. Go and be amazing besties with the people that have been doing the work for your region or the regions that you're a part of, or just American wine in general, because those are people that are going to help you build your brand, because they're getting the customers that are coming in looking for those kinds of wines.
I have a question for our listeners. I want people to write in podcast@vinepair.com. What do you think an appropriate punishment should be for restaurants that don't only sell American wine?
Or don't, like, include an American wine on their wine list?
Yeah, like fines, jail time, what? Like, please tell us.
Well, and with that, this is a spicy one. I'll talk to you both on Thursday.
Have a nice week.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Jabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.